Thank you all very much. Now, I did not, actually rather purposely, make up a lot of PowerPoint slides because, you know, there have been significant studies that show that PowerPoint make people stupid, right? One of the reasons that the space shuttle blew up a few years ago was because of a bad PowerPoint presentation. No, seriously, because NASA took some facts and buried them way deep on the slide so the engineers didn't notice, and everyone was pointing fingers afterward and people were dead, but it was all PowerPoint. So, in 1999, one of my friends called me. I was living in America at the time from Amsterdam to tell me that she was pregnant. I was absolutely overjoyed for her. And it was the oddest thing because as her pregnancy progressed, I started getting, I couldn't even know what to call it, sort of flashes, as if the baby was beaming me from the womb. Now, of course, we know that that didn't happen, but in essence, I was starting to see the world that this child, who was born in September of 2000, was growing up in. And I could see that that world didn't look anything like the world that I'd grown up in when I was born in 1962. And that started me on an entire journey, and the outcome of that journey was this book called The Playful World, How Technology is Transforming Our Education. This copy is for your library, okay, so hopefully you'll be able to check it out and look at it. And I did it not so much for the children, to help them understand the world they were growing up in, but for the parents, because the parents were the ones who were going to have trouble understanding the degree of the changes that had happened, perhaps even in the last 10 years before that child was born. And I broke the book down into three major sections, which were the three different trends that I could see that were converging to change the way that children were understanding the world. I broke it down into the three sections of intelligence, activity, and presence. And what I did for each of these sections was I took a toy that embodied this transformation into an object. The nice thing about a toy is that toys are completely non-threatening. You can talk about very sophisticated subjects, but if you talk about them using a toy as an example, no one gets afraid. So I could use a toy, and the toy I used to talk about intelligence was the Furby, which you're all familiar with, all right? The Furby seems very innocuous, except it actually embodies a lot of ideas that are very sophisticated from the field of artificial intelligence and from the idea of interactivity. And the way I was able to sort of open up the book by starting with the Furby, and you should have seen me writing my book. I had my little two Furbies side by side, and I had them chatting with each other as I'm sitting there writing. And I went to my mom's place in Florida when I wrote. She just didn't know what the heck was going on. I was sitting there with these toys in front of my keyboard. Sherry Turkle is a scientist and a psychologist of child development at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. She's done a lot of work. She was married to Seymour Papert, who was instructed by Jean Piaget. She's done a lot of work in childhood development, particularly where it relates to technology. And so in 1999, just about the same time that the Furby was introduced and was a wild success, she said, okay, let me take a look at how kids are interacting with Furbies. Now, in terms of the developmental stages, 4, 5, 6 years old are where children start to understand the different qualities of objects. They understand the difference between an animate object and an inanimate object. Between 4 and 6, where this quality starts to emerge. So she took kids who had Furbies and she sat and she interviewed them. And she said, okay, is your Furby more like a ball? Is your Furby more like a puppy? And know what the kids said? Neither. They said, it's not like either of those things. So the kids, after being exposed to this object, which was not alive, and they knew it was not animate, and yet at the same time, they knew that it was not inanimate, they refused to place it in either category. So the kids were generating, as it were, an ontological third class, something that wasn't animate, something that wasn't inanimate, something that was in between those two, and they were comfortable with that. But this is something that, in some sense, some grown-ups, when they see a Furby, they feel a little creepy about it because it's kind of alive and it's kind of not alive. Well, the reason that we, as grown-ups, feel a little bit creepy about it is because it's not fitting into any of those neat categories. So the Furby, as cute and innocuous and silly and commercial as it is a way to be able to discuss the enormous transformations that technology and all this technology, which we're consistently, constantly putting in front of our kids, is actually profoundly transforming their sense of expectations for the world. Now, I am in part because of the amount of research I did for this book, but I think just also because of my philosophical inclination, I'm a constructivist, all right? So you can put me very clearly and squarely in the Piaget school of childhood development, that I do believe that children develop an ontological model of the world by interacting with the world, all right? That in fact, children are relatively good scientists, they're relatively good explorers, that they'll develop a philosophical model and test that model until it breaks, reform that model, and continue to build from it. We've started to give children objects with different ontological qualities than anything that you or I grew up with. Their philosophies on how the world works are in some ways fundamentally different. And so what I really want to do over the next hour-ish is take some very specific areas and talk about those points of difference. Number one, the elephant in the living room, the World Wide Web. Now, if I did my math correctly, your grade 12 students were born in about 1989, and your grade 1 students were born in about 2000. And the web came around in terms of popular understanding in 94 and 95, which means that even your oldest students have never really known a world without the World Wide Web. Now, I was 30 when the World Wide Web came out. So for me, it was a bit of a sea change. I'd done a bunch of research in hypertext systems before that, so I was actually very anxious for the World Wide Web and very excited when it came out. But for most people, it was just something that profoundly appeared basically out of nowhere. For all of us, it's something completely new and something that we've had to sort of adjust to. For everyone who's in your school, it's always been around. If you want to use another metaphor, let's flip back 120 years. It's like electricity. People were around when electricity came into houses. None of us think twice about electricity. Electricity is simply omnipresent, except when the power goes out, but it's simply present in our environment, and it's just simply part of what we accept as being a natural quality of our environment. Now, let me do some comparisons. I'm 43 years old, and so if we're trying to sort of make some comparisons to the kids who were born, might be in grade 3 or grade 4, touch-tone dialing was introduced in 1964, and color television broadcasting in America, happened a little bit later in Australia, was introduced in 1965. Who doesn't think about touch-tone dialing? Who doesn't think about color broadcasting? You turn on the television set and there's a black and white broadcast. You're either slapping your TV set or you're realizing you're watching an old broadcast. Both of those technologies are completely ubiquitous now. So you have now a generation of kids, the entire body of your kids, has never, ever known a world without the web. Okay. What does this mean? Well, the principal thing that we can see immediately is that their relationship to information, their relationship to knowledge, their relationship to facts is completely different than ours. That they expect, simply because it's always been the case, that facts and information and knowledge is always at hand, period. There's never a place where it's not always at hand, and they don't worry about that. Now, for you folks, this actually produces an enormous responsibility because there are all sorts of facts that are available online, all sorts of information that's available online, all sorts of knowledge that's available online, but children do not know how to discriminate. And so the most important role now for us as people who are, and there's a little theory about being digital natives and digital immigrants. We're all the digital immigrants. They're all the digital natives. That in fact, what's going on here is that we need to impart to them a sense of discrimination, that this is the job of the parent, the mentor, the teacher, and the peer. All right? But it's really in that descending order of importance. That if we don't teach them the ability to discriminate facts, discriminate truth from falsity, discriminate opinion from proven fact, among the entire swirling sea of rumor that is the internet, then what they're going to grow up with is this ability to have command of information, but no ability to be able to use it wisely. All right. So the generational imperative from us as teachers to them as the folks who are entirely gifted in this ubiquitous universal sea of information, is that we have to give them the gift of discernment. All right. We're going to come back to the web because it sort of flows to this conversation, but I wanted to open up with that. Now, when I first came to Sydney on my first visit, which was 1996, I was astounded by the fact that half the population were carrying these around. And in America, the mobile phone took off a lot more slowly. There's a bunch of theoretical reasons for why this might be. America has always had a very, very strong wired telephone infrastructure. It wasn't that it was a big place and took a long time to wire. Same thing's true in Australia, highly urban population. But for whatever reason, mobile phones didn't really start taking off or reach critical mass in America until almost 2000. But I found, being this sort of alien, thrust into this alien culture where everyone was talking on their mobile phones, that it actually profoundly changed the way that all of us interacted. That if you're coordinating an evening with friends, it was no longer going to be a hit and miss affair because SMS messages would start bouncing back and forth between everyone involved and everyone would suddenly magically appear at the right place at the right time. That in fact, the ability of the mobile phone to act as this sort of telepathy between widely separated groups of people was incredible, and it impressed me in that respect. And I still went back to America and didn't get a mobile phone. Now, there's an element here in everything that I'm saying of a bit of my own philosophy, which is what you might call technological determinism. A technological determinism says that if I give you something that's a technological artifact that you're going to interact with in some way, you will change in response to this artifact. You might get rid of it, but if you actually use it, if you adapt to it, it changes you. And this is true with the web. This is true also with the mobile phone. Now, in 1996, it would be unlikely even in Australia to find someone under 16 with a mobile phone. I did a little poll of the audience right now. What age are kids getting their mobile phones now? Is it 10-ish? 8? Yeah, so it's 8 to 10. I have 10 to 12 here because I was being a little conservative. But it's 8, right? Because mommy wants to be able to get in touch with him at any point. All right. So that there's an actual sort of security need that the parent has. And of course, the Disney company has just introduced their own mobile phone network in America. And when you get the Disney phones and give them to the kids, they've got GPS in them so you can track the kids wherever they are. What more could a super protective mommy want? She can go to the website and find out exactly where her kids are. All right. So we've now dropped almost 10 years. We've dropped 8 years in the range of where kids are getting mobile phones. Now, part of that is because the price has dropped, but part of that is simply because they're seen as an essential element in modern communication, in the family, between friends, in business, and everything like this. And so essentially, we're giving kids a mobile phone as soon as they're old enough to really understand what it is and to be able to use it wisely. And in fact, they're coming out with mobile phones that are meant for six-year-olds but have very, you know, simplified button systems. You could have one button to call mommy, one button to call help, whatever it might be. And so we're going to see this device in some form, maybe not exactly the same form as adults have it, become more and more a completely pervasive part of what the child is doing. Now, how does that change their behavior? One of the differences between the way we as grown-ups use communication technology, the pervasive communication technology, and the way children, or the younger generation, this is really people under 25, but particularly people under 18, use communication technology, is that adults will tend to be a little bit more formal in their approach to it. We will tend to use email. Children will tend to use texting and IMing. All right? They're immediate and yet they're asynchronous. You know, you can send someone to text, but you don't have to reply right away. You can send someone an IM, but you don't have to answer. So they've got sort of some of the features of email, some of the advantages, some of the disadvantages of email. There is a clear generational preference. This is very clear with respect to SMS, that the SMS generation doesn't send as much email. They tend to send a lot more SMS. This is very pronounced not only in Australia, but also in Europe and definitely in Asia. Michiko Ito wrote a book last year. I'll try to send you the link for it because I didn't grab that. She's a Japanese woman. Her family is extremely well known as sort of being a pioneering, technologically advanced Japanese family. Her brother introduced a lot of internet technology into Japan in the 1960s. In the 1990s. And she did a study on how Japanese children are using their mobile phones in the context of their culture and their relationships. And she's discovered a phenomenon which she calls co-presence. Let me explain what co-presence is in very simple terms. Essentially, what will happen is Japanese kids will be going to a bunch of different schools, they'll live in different bunches of towns, but what'll happen is you might have four or five close friends in your circle. And from the moment you wake up in the morning to the moment you go to sleep at night, there's this constant casual stream of SMS communication. May not be about anything important, just pinging them. And this cloud of communication lasts for the entire day, all right? And it's hard to manage five slow speed, kind of asynchronous communications with five different people on a mobile phone. The interface on a mobile phone really isn't tuned for that. And the fact that the kids are making the phone do this, even though the phone doesn't really do it well, is telling us that this is what, for the kids, the phone is really about. That it's not about this sort of continuous gab, 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 gab. It's more about this gentle sort of enveloping cloud of connection that's just sort of always there. And it's something that we would think about if we grew up in a small town, we'd just sort of always have our mates around. We wouldn't think about it. They'd always be there. We could run over someone else's house and talk to them or whatever. With the kids, this is no longer sort of bounded by proximity. All right? These are friends because they choose to be friends, but they may not be living in the same town, may not be living in the same part of the country. And yet at the same time, they're constantly maintaining this very gentle but very persistent web of communication all the hours that they're awake. Now, what does that mean? I wish I knew. This is one of the things that I'm studying right now. I don't understand yet, and I don't think even the kids understand yet, what it means about the quality or tenor or strength of their relationships, or what it means in terms of their ability to communicate, or what it means in terms of their ability to have real-world relationships. Is this altering it? Is it changing it? But it's there, and it's a very important phenomenon. And it may be that by the time this decade runs out, or even the next decade runs out, we have a much better understanding of what this means. Right now, it's just only been identified. All right. Media. So when I grew up in the United States, there were three commercial broadcasting networks, CBS, NBC, and ABC, and one public broadcaster. When most of you grew up in Australia, there were three commercial networks, 7, 9, and 10, and one public broadcaster, ABC. And of course, in the 1980s to 1990s, this began to multiply, so that you got cable television. I don't know when the original cable television came out in Australia. Was it mid-80s-ish, mid-early 90s? You guys got it a little bit later than we got it. We started getting heavy cable in America around 1985. You guys probably got it 90 to 95. And so you got this multiplying set of different channels to watch. And of course, the entire world started to go digital in terms of media between 1980 and 1995. So that you have music going digital with the compact disc, which was introduced in 1982. You have the DVD being introduced in 1995. And you have internet-delivered media, so streaming media, whatever you want to call it, also being launched in 1995. And it's taken a fair length of time for the full impact of that revolution to be felt. But one of the curious things that no one had expected, particularly not the recording companies or the film industries, was that when you take some sort of media and digitize it, it becomes something else in and of itself. It's no longer really just a film. It's no longer really just a song or an album. It's something else. It's now an object. It's a digital object. And that digital object can now be, well, what are the kids doing with them? All right? The kids are sharing them. Now this is driving the record companies bananas. This is driving the film companies bananas. All right? But the natural inclination of these kids is to simply share all of this media around with each other. Now, one of the reasons that the kids don't feel like they're doing anything wrong here, it's not because they haven't been taught that it's not stealing. I'm sure there are a lot of adults saying that there are things wrong with it, you shouldn't steal, blah, 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 blah. That's really got nothing to do with it. It's that these kids live in an age where media is being broadcast at them from every available point all of the time. So the relative value of any piece of media is not in the fact that someone created it. It's in the fact that they like it and they want to share it with their friends. All right? This is the key point, that in fact, in the world that we're heading into, in the world that they're in, media has value only insofar as they can share it, and that they can actually maybe gain some social credit by being the first one to find something and share it with their friends, or, you know, happen to know the same song. And of course, you know, pop music works like this, and everyone likes the same pop song or whatever it might be. But more and more, people are forming their own communities, and we'll come to this in the next section, and finding pieces of media to share across their communities. And they've started to think that it's sort of in the nature of media itself to be something that you can carry around with you, something you can pass along, something you can forward, something you can share. And it's because the media is really as ubiquitous these days, and it's basically to them as free as air. They don't think of it as something that you go to the theater to see, or that you have to be in front of the TV set at a particular time to watch. It's something that's just always around, whether it's someone carrying something on their iPod, or it's something that someone's got on their mobile phone, or it's something they found on the computer, or someone handed them a DVD. It doesn't matter. It's coming at them from all sides. And so the value in any of it is in how much they can share it and enjoy it in their circle of friends. Now, something I want to ask you here, this is one of the questions I want to throw into the audience today, is education, sort of take that out, just make it a sort of pure Platonic thing, a medium, all right? Is what you're doing, beyond the raw task of mentoring, which is the extremely human and embodied part of the task, and the part of the task that you can't record because it requires the presence of a child and a teacher, but is part of what you're doing a medium? Can you make it so that it can be traded and shared and freely given away and people can get excited about it and find it? You know, I'm sitting here putting this talk on my iPod this morning. That's, by the way, that was the excuse I used for buying myself an iPod. Oh, I've got to record my lectures. Yeah, that's it. All right. But it does serve me well in this purpose, and so that I can record it on my iPod so that I can then produce a podcast of it and put that up on my website, because part of what I can do, even though this is a very specific talk about a very specific thing, is I can share this insofar as someone wants to listen to me talk about education. Kids may also want to do that if they hear a really good lecture, if there's something they need to be able to communicate about, if there's something they need to really think hard about. Can you take the education or some portion of your education and treat it as a medium so that you can digitize it and they can freely share it? All right. Now, no doubt all of you have heard of something called MySpace. Yeah? Have people not heard of MySpace? Okay, all right. There is a basic theorem in sociology called the 6 degrees of separation theorem, that we're separated from any other person on the planet by no more than 5 intermediate people. In Australia, that's 2 people, I've noticed. One of the beautiful things about Australia, you can never act out in Australia because everyone will know right away. And so what people started to do around 3 years ago really, was to take this understanding of the 6 degrees of separation and then build computer databases and websites around this phenomenon. So the first one was something called Friendster. And I'll describe, I think about a month before I got to Sydney on my trip in 2003, one of my friends handed me a link to join up with this thing called Friendster. And Friendster is a digital social network. In other words, what I do is I create a little profile page talking about myself, and I can then link to the profile pages of all of my friends. And because my friends are weird geeks like I am, a lot of my friends already had profiles in the system. And so I established my Friendster page, and I had links after about a week of very crack-like sitting online and looking for my friends' profiles, connections out to my friends' pages, and then you could connect from their pages to other pages. So you had this beautiful sort of map of the, not 6 degrees, but the 3 degrees of connectivity. So I might know someone in New York City or in Omaha, Nebraska, or in Sydney through one or two different intermediaries. And Friendster sort of provided a way to set all of that up. And Friendster was kind of cool, and then MySpace came along and just sort of kicked its butt up and down the street. So MySpace is a digital social network where kids, mostly kids, and these are, they won't let anyone under 14 join, but between 14 and 25, it's completely ubiquitous. And there are, I think, 70 million profile pages on MySpace. That's as of today. and it is now the second most visited site on the internet. Okay? It's almost up to Yahoo. It's past Google. That's how big MySpace is. And the interesting thing about MySpace is that it's got a sort of very free form, so that kids can come in and create their own profile pages, and they can stick media on it. So they can stick their favorite MP3 that they're listening to. They can stick a little movie that they found somewhere. So that these pages tend to look, well, pretty bad, sort of in this very quaint, cute sort of way, but at the same time, they're also a creative product of the person. And because it's a digital social network, you can say, here are my friends, and here are links to all of my friends, and here are the links to the bands that I think are cool, and here are links to things that I think are cool, and so on and so forth. All right. Social networks. We've always had them. A social network is part of being a human being. Since we, you know, crawled out of the valleys in the Serengeti, we've had social networks. And in fact, even chimpanzees have social networks, because something that we understand now from some anthropology is what's called the Dunbar number. It turns out the number of people that you can sort of have in your head as your social network is directly correlated to the amount of gray matter you have. So chimpanzees, who've got a lot less gray matter, they can have between 20 and 30 other chimpanzees in their social network. Human beings, we do better, we can have 150. But that's pretty much it. Apparently, that's, you know, if you claim, and there are people who have Friendster pages and MySpace pages with, you know, oh, I have 1,000 friends. And if you count all your friends and all your family, really it's always going to max out at around 150. But we've got now these digital social networks to sort of provide the other half of the connection. We're carrying it around in our head, but now we're starting to put it into the computers. And so we're taking these natural social networks and we're reinforcing them with technology, which makes them a little bit easier to manage, all right? For instance, Friendster, which I'm still on, will send me a reminder every 2 weeks of all of the birthdays of my other Friendster friends who are coming up. And I've been sending people birthday greetings because I happen to know what their birthdays are. I would never have tracked that before, except for a very few close friends in my family. But now I'll send someone a little note on their birthday. So it can do cool things like that, or marginally cool things like that. But what they also then become are places for people to share moments of self-expression around their friends. Now, you've all heard the word blog, probably? Okay, so. What is a blog? That's a really slippery subject. It's not one thing, it's not another. You can say that it's a form of an electronic diary. All right, that's one definition of what a blog is. I keep two different blogs. I keep a blog on LiveJournal, which is a very, very popular blogging site, which is my personal stuff. Hi, this is what's going on. Here's the trouble I'm having with the Department of Immigration right now, blah, 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 blah. All right, I also keep a professional blog. And the professional blog is where I actually post generally once a week an essay. All right, and these are my thoughts about specific issues that are of current interest to me, and I'll compose an essay on it because I had very good English teachers when I was in high school. I'm a fairly well-known essayist. Thank you all, by the way. If any of you are teaching English, thank you all. And it's something that I really enjoy, and it's not what's going on in my life. It's these are issues that are important to me. So it's not a newspaper. It's not a personal journal, and yet it's a journal. And both of those are blogs, and both of those are legitimately blogs. So a blog is not one thing or another. It's very much driven by the creative need of the person who's creating the blog. LiveJournal is really interesting because it takes the concepts of a social network and combines them with the idea of a blog, so that I have bunches of friends in LiveJournal who can read my journal. And every time I post a new entry, they get notified about it. And I can also post entries that I've decided that only my friends can read because they're covering material that I don't want the rest of the world to know about. The next generation of mobile phones that are just being introduced now will all have blogging software built into them, so that the younger generation, from wherever they are, will be able to make a blogging entry. Maybe that's sending a picture to a blog. Maybe that's a little line of text. I mean, obviously, it's hard to type anything of any length into a mobile phone. But that may not be important. It may be just important enough to note a moment and to be able to share that moment with their circle of friends. And so what are they doing? Well, here's the horrible, awesome truth about social networks. Social networks, of course, are an innate part of being human. But they're also the innate part. This is a personal opinion here, but I think that research will back this up over the next 5 years or so, are what make teenage girls so crazy. All right? The difference between men and women is that women tend to pay a lot more attention and devote a lot more of their cognitive brain power to the management of their social networks, that this appears to be an evolutionary imperative. Women intensely invest themselves in their social networks, boys less so. What they're starting to do, and what we're starting to do now in the blogging revolution and the MySpace revolution, is not being led by boys. It's being led by girls. That this is a form of technology which girls feel most at home at. That in fact they're investing themselves in very fully. And what they're doing in these social networks is that they're exploring their ways to be able to maintain their social networks, to be able to improve their social networks, and to, of course, improve their standing within social networks. So all of these forces are at work driving this. Now, this always, you know, with any clique in any school, with any group of girls, there's always going to be that jockeying. Now that's being reinforced and it's being amplified by the digital nature of social networks. So we're going to start to see some very interesting forms pop out of this. We haven't really started to see this yet. I mean, the thing that we do know about blogging already, and it's really only been around for 2 or 3 years, is that it's completely changing the news industry. All right, you know, I go and talk to Fairfax about blogging and they just get a very, very white look because they understand that they're going to have to make some sort of accommodation with blogging in order to move into the 21st century as a news organization. And it's not just that their reporters are blogging, which they're doing now, because when everyone is blogging, why do you need a reporter? Well, there's an answer to that, but we still don't quite know what the precise dimension of that answer is. And when everyone's reading everyone else's journals, what does that mean about the way communities are working and knowledge spreads among communities? And social networks aren't just about sort of sharing the minutia of one's life. They're also about spreading information and knowledge in media. So if I get a video track that's really cool, I use my social network to spread that track out because it's something that I'm really interested in and my friends are going to be really interested in. And so what this means is that when I find something cool, I will immediately share that with my social network because it raises my cool rating with my peers. All right? This is the publishing model of the 21st century. It's not based on a centralized broadcasting model. It's based on the fact that everyone's sort of competing to be top dog in their social network. And so what we're going to see more and more is that these social networks, supported by these digital communications technologies, are going to amplify the ability for the kids to be able to either create something, and this is a very important point, and that's why the blog is so important, because it's the tip of that creativity, either create something or find something. Now, I've identified a phenomenon. I've tried to give it the best possible name. I call it the three Fs: finding, filtering, and forwarding. All right? This is sort of the root of what's going on now with both adults and kids in relationship to media, social networks, and electronic communication. You think about the number of emails that you get a day that aren't business related, but are from sort of friends or family, and then count the number of those that have links in them to something, either to a web page or to an MP3 track or to a movie, whatever it might be, all right? That's the broadcasting network of the 21st century. It's not what's coming over the pipe from Channel 9, all right? It's the fact that what we're getting are these inboxes that are filled with media. And they're media that are coming to us because someone found it and they decided, in other words, they filtered and they said, oh, this is good for Mark, this is good for Jane, this is good for Erica, whatever it might be, all right? And then they forwarded it to us. And we're doing it as well, because how often do you find something and go, wow, that's really interesting, or wow, that's really cool, and you immediately send it off to a couple of your friends. All right? So we're all doing this, and we're all doing it more and more and more. And the kids are all doing it completely ubiquitously. This is completely native behavior to them. All right? So we have media, we have social networks, and they're coming together, and they're creating the way that the kids are finding out about things now. Are your ears bleeding yet? All right. So, participation culture. Now, my own particular theory, now I have only ever taught at the graduate school level. So let me just say from the bottom of my heart how brave I feel you are. All right. Even for me teaching at, well, I guess undergraduates are just meant to be surly and bored. But that's how I've always found it. I've never taught at a grade school level, so I don't really understand the techniques for how you seduce them into learning something. All right. My gut feeling, only because I know the way that I learned when I was growing up, was that children are hungry to learn at the points of relevance, at the things that they're really, really obsessive about. And kids have an enormous capability to be obsessive about God knows what. And this is, in some sense, the theoretical foundation for the Montessori school, for that sort of enrichment education. Now, the point of relevance for a child is, I think, from our point of view, the opportunity that they're presenting to us to get them to participate in the creation of culture. So, adults have caught up with the participation mystique in one very specific electronic embodiment. Now, you've all probably heard of Wikipedia. Okay, have you all, who has not used Wikipedia in this room? Okay, so a few people. Oh, and depending on whether we get things up, we may have a look at it. No hurry. Yeah, it's fine, but there's absolutely no hurry here. All right, let me go and explain for a minute what Wikipedia is. So Wikipedia is an encyclopedia. But the interesting thing about it is it's an encyclopedia that anyone can edit. All right. So it started off very small as 15,000 entries that were donated to it into the public domain from an encyclopedia called the Newpedia. And then what they did is they got a very active community of people who would add entries. And when people checked the encyclopedia out and tried to find an entry and the entry wasn't there, they were invited to create the entry. And the entry might have been very basic, but then someone else would come and visit the site and they'd add a little bit more and they'd add a little bit more. And of course, it's the old, old, old fairy tale of the stone soup. Right? So there's nothing in this pot at the beginning. Oh, look at, there's a great stone soup cooking, and someone comes and adds some carrots, and someone adds some onions, and then someone adds some meat, and you have a really, really good stew going. And the thing about Wikipedia that made it so amazing was that at a certain point, say 2 years ago, it just sort of took off on its own. There was enough there that was relevant to enough people that people just started to continually visit it, continually improve it. And so it got into this very virtuous cycle of constant improvement. So it started off as 15,000 entries. When I checked it last night, it was up to 1.1 million entries in English, 2 million across the other languages, on all sorts of different subjects. And I was actually going to look to see if there was a page about the school. Is there a page about the school in Wikipedia?
But I looked you up on that last night.
Yeah. There's a story about how I ended up with a Wikipedia entry. But that's another story. We won't go into it just yet. Okay, so adults have really caught fire with this participation mystique, and so they've now produced an encyclopedia that, depending on who you ask, is nearly or maybe more accurate than Encyclopedia Britannica. There's a bit of argument in the intellectual and scientific and academic communities about this right now. But it's not so heavily weighed in favor of either Britannica or Wikipedia right now. It's got, in terms of the raw number of articles, 9 times the number of articles the Britannica does, because Britannica is not going to have articles about weird characters in video games from the 1980s. Wikipedia does, because someone cared enough to create an entry on it. So Wikipedia is becoming, in some sense, not just an encyclopedia, but it's becoming an index to culture. All right? And that, in fact, is attracting more and more and more. So, excellent. All right, yeah, no, that's fine. So that's up. So yeah, we can take a look at it, but don't want to interrupt flow here. So somehow Wikipedia found a way to close the gap in the point of relevance between adults and Wikipedia's desire to sort of grow and learn. In other words, if you were an expert in something, one way of being able to express that expertise was to be able to create or maintain or to add to a Wikipedia entry. All right. So for example, I think the first time that I edited a Wikipedia entry was immediately before I came to Australia to live. Arnold Schwarzenegger was elected governor of California. And I was living in California at the time. I didn't vote for him. It doesn't matter. And so election night, I'm sitting and I'm watching the returns coming in, and I've got Arnold Schwarzenegger's biography page open in Wikipedia, and I'm making changes to it. There you go. And the changes were up for a couple of weeks, and I think they got revised by someone else and so on and so forth. Fine. Now, last year, wasn't it just a year? It was almost exactly a year ago that Charles married Camilla, right? I think it was April last year. And I'm watching the broadcast live on Channel 9 or whatever, and I'm figuring, oh, I really don't know anything about Camilla, so I go to her Wikipedia page, and there it is. I'm like, okay, all that stuff, oh, that's interesting. And then I realize I'm in the right place at the right time to be able to update Camilla's page to make a note of her wedding. And I wait until they pop out of the Windsor Civic Court, and I reload the page, and someone's already done it. And that's when I realized, of course, that's a very big news event, but seriously, it's very hard to find. There are so many people who are sort of constantly swarming around the idea of what Wikipedia is. There are so many people swarming around it that it's kind of hard to sort of get in front of something if it's at all popular. So, somehow, Wikipedia has managed to engage the adults of this world in this process of a creation of a cultural artifact, which is an artifact that is useful for everybody. And the question then is, can we find similar sorts of artifacts, similar sorts of forms of participation that will work for kids? In other words, is it possible to hijack that instinct and then to use that for an educational purpose? And I think that that's true, but I think it varies strongly from child to child. Now, I have one educational recommendation for you. It's my only sort of strong recommendation today. But I do have one strong recommendation, which is that I think it should be a requirement for every student about year 8, because I think by then they'll have the necessary grasp of the skills, to find a subject that does not have a Wikipedia entry or only has a stub entry and have them create an entry on that subject. Because you've got English composition skills, you've got literacy skills, you've got research skills, and you've got online skills that all need to come together into a solid form for that. And the thing is, if a kid's doing it about something that they're really interested in, then it's going to be a project that they're going to love, and it's going to be something that's going to be up there. It's going to be something that they'll always be able to point to and say, I contributed this to the common good. And you know, that may in fact be updating the Canopy Rose Bay page as well. Pardon me? Provided you guys have one. Pardon me?
We haven't started creating Wikipedia. I've just tried.
Well, there's your place to start. There you go. You're all set. You've got your perfect starting point. Now, so there are some other questions that I want to throw out to you with respect to participation culture, because we talked about lots of examples of participation culture leading up to this. So are your students blogging, and do you know, and should you know? These are all different questions. Are they on MySpace, and do you know, and should you know? Are they participating in this creative culture, or are they simply absorbing this creative culture? And why is that? These are questions that we do need to answer, because they're questions that have to go with the utility of the kinds of things that you're trying to teach them when you're trying to impart to them the lessons they'll need to do to become full citizens in the culture. All right, good. And that's where, this is the page that I haven't written, but it's the page that I'm closest to. So I don't have anything written for it, but I was hoping there would be time, and there is time, and I'll be able to go on to it. All right. Now, so I talked about the Furby in here, and I talked about Lego's Mindstorms, which is a very wonderful set of Lego building blocks that are programmable Lego blocks. And then the last thing I talked about in this book was the PlayStation 2, which was released on the same day that this book was released, and that wasn't an accident. I had planned it this way. Because I wanted to talk about virtual reality and simulation, and I really only used that as a framework to talk about a project that I had seen a few years before, which had radically changed my view of the world. The project was called T-Vision, and T-Vision required $250,000 graphics supercomputer to be installed, and what it did was it presented you, drawn live from satellite data, a view of the Earth. And it had this enormous, enormous trackball. All right, and I mean, it was a trackball, it was a meter wide, and you could put your hand on the trackball and move it back and forth, and lo and behold, the Earth on the screen over here, running off the $250,000 computer, would do that. And you could press a button and you could zoom right down in, and you could pop right back out again, and it just blew me away. And I realized, and I wrote about this in the book, that within a few years' time, the globe on the desk in the teacher's classroom was going to be replaced by this active object. And then last year, Google goes and releases Google Earth. All right. And I was the happiest human being in the world, because I had been waiting for this. I had done simplified versions of this and put them on my website using VRML. And one of the objects in inventing VRML, I didn't only use it, I invented it back in 94, was, no, it's all right, was to actually create a platform that people could use to do 3D visualizations of the world, all right? Because to me, I saw this as being an essential part of what kids would be learning in the 21st century, that the world is not a static object, that it's not boundaries and lines. In fact, it's an active object, and that the better we can do at giving them tools to see this and to build models out of it and to be able to understand how doing something here affects something here, affects something here, affects something here, and we now have those tools, the better that they'll be able to go out and work in a world which is very interdependent and also very precariously balanced across any number of different areas. And we can actually give them these tools by teaching them now how to use tools like Google Earth. So are any of you using Google Earth in the classroom? Excellent. No. I mean, it just seems to me that it's a real sort of no-brainer in terms of being able to teach about geography, particularly in a country that is as vast as this one, all right? Where, you know, you can zoom down on Sydney, and I think I now have the lat-long coordinates of my house memorized. You can zoom down on Sydney if you want, but then you can take a look at the outback or any other place and all the different sort of geologies of Australia and all the different ecologies of Australia are all immediately available for view to understand. Well, what's happening? If we misfire a missile at Woomera, what does that mean for Adelaide? All right. Or if something happens down in Hobart, what does that mean for Launceston or something? You know, all these different things can now be brought into some form of an apprehensible whole. And again, Google Earth is a participatory project, because Google sort of provides the ground level of it. But then you can create any number of different overlays for it. So if a kid is interested enough in something, they can work on a project that will annotate Google Earth. And that annotation can then be shared with the entire Google Earth community. All right? And you know that teachers are creating all sorts of annotations, and they're sharing them. So it's actually working a couple different ways. Participatory culture is a multi-way street. It's not just the kid learning how to share. It's you as educators learning how to share and how to learn what's been shared. All right. To me, Google Earth is the ultimate toy. All right. I'm not saying that I won't ever want another toy after that. But in terms of what I really had wanted from widespread adoption of the internet and widespread adoption of 3D, that's it. That's the sweet spot. And to me, it's the beginning. If we can figure out how to harness it as something that ties together geography and history and culture and religion, all of these different things that have to do in some deep sense with where we are on the planet, I think that's probably a good place to stop.